You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Hey, summer's over, I think. And so let's get down to business here. Austin Peterson is in the studio with us, editor of the Libertarian Republic. TheLibertarianRepublic.com is the website. And there's a new Austin, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great to have you with us. So last week, this Pew poll came out that talked about the 11% of the respondents who said that they, yes, I'm a libertarian. And then they said, well, what do you think then about things like police should be able to stop and search people who look like criminals, 42%, which is pretty much the same as the general population. Sure. We can go through it. Oh, 41% believe that government should regulate business. 46% believe that corporations make too much profit. 38% believe that government aid to the poor is good. Then you go back and you look at the libertarian platform that David Koch ran on in 1980, which is pretty much still the libertarian platform. The repeal of the FEC, the federal election finance laws, abolition of Medicare and Medicaid, deregulation of the medical insurance industry, repeal of the increasingly oppressive Social Security system, abolish the government post office. We oppose all personal and corporate taxation, including capital gains. All criminal and civil sanctions against tax evasion should be terminated immediately. We're opposed to minimum wage laws. We're opposed to government schools, the EPA, the DOT, the FAA, Amtrak, the FDA, all aid to the poor programs, all inland waterways. The Koch brothers should be able to own the Mississippi River.
Right. Well, those are all the things that your liberal viewers are going to agree with you on, Tom. But what about all the platform things?
I don't think so.
But what about the things that that they're going to disagree with? But what about all the things they're going to agree with, like ending the wars, ending the war on drugs? You know, don't you think that that you're kind of like stiffing your listeners by not telling them of all the things that they might agree with in libertarians?
Well, this is an important point. And this is why I've said for years that libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid and don't want to fight in a war, thank you very much. And, you know, I get that, but we're Republicans part. We're conservatives economically part. That part, you know, most people I don't think know.
But what about same-sex marriage? What about equality? What about things like the militarization of police? What about race issues where the libertarians stand arm-in-arm with the progressive allies to try and reduce the militarization of our police? You know, we saw this situation out with Michael Brown in St. Louis, and now we have conservative Republicans standing up against the militarization of our local police forces. You had obviously
right, but they're on the flip side of that, they are not going to say anything about things like equal rights laws. In fact, you've got people like, you know, Ron Paul saying that it was a mistake to even pass the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act.
Well, he's actually rescinded that comment
he
made.
Ron Paul, not Rand.
Well, Ron Paul perhaps, but Rand Paul is the person who is of consequence right now. Ron Paul,
I know, because he's running for president, so he's
retired.
Not going to be quite as stupid, or he's not going to be quite as honest as his father was.
Perhaps.
His father what's the word for somebody who's a presidential candidate but not really a presidential candidate?
Dennis Kucinich candidate. Third party-ish, I would say, perhaps.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's about principles, Tom. And, you know, we can debate the Civil Rights Act, you and I, and Title II is specifically the section that we would have to discuss, you know, whether or not, you know, it comes down to the same question of the gay marriage, the gay wedding cakes, right? Should I be forced to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple if I don't agree with it?
Should you be forced to let black people sit at your lunch counter?
That is the question. If you don't agree with that.
And libertarians would say, no, you shouldn't be forced to serve a black person at your lunch counter if it offends your religion, which was Mormonism until 1987, if it offends your personal sensibilities. That's not something I think most Americans
liberty is sometimes with. It sometimes breeds ugliness because
that's,
it allows
that's
it,
not liberty
it, yeah well it
that's
is
not liberty,
liberty
for
is,
black people
well it's not liberty for
and black
not
people
liberty,
are part of this country
well you're right it's not and liberty it's, because it creates the use of force onto people's private property, and that is where the government gets the right to come in and tell you that you can't get married, because it's saying, well, conservatives will say, oh, well, you can't intrude on my definition of marriage, so the government will define marriage as one man and one
but
woman.
The fact of the matter
so
is
your,
that both
your
of
own
those
philosophy
businesses.
Negates
No,
your
not
own
true.
Principles.
Both of those businesses, whether it's the wedding cake business or whether it's the coffee shop or the diner restaurant down in New Orleans or in Mississippi or Alabama or Georgia, both of them are being given special privileges by we the people for incorporating.
Okay.
And that's something that you guys want to perpetuate.
In fact, you want
to do away with corporate taxes.
Not libertarians. No. Wait a minute.
Libertarians
don't want special... The Chamber of Commerce Republicans want special privileges.
The Libertarian Party has never come out and said that they are opposed to limited liability protection for corporations.
Well, they never said that. Well, they're opposed to the
United States government.
They're
totally in favor of that.
Well, they want protections because they've got the government coming in and stepping on
their toes. Okay, so you want protections for corporations, but you don't want protections for black people. This is a wonderful talking point for affluent young white libertarians.
You're conflating Republicans with libertarians, and libertarians are a philosophical bent. Republicans are the corporatist stooges that you're degrading. And I think that the point is that you have to separate that philosophy. Okay.
Well, I am talking about libertarians.
But libertarians don't want special benefits for corporations. We are against corporatism that you've talked about in many of your books that I've read. The corporatists are the problem.
The Libertarian Party, I know this for a fact, is not at all.
You should not have to get a license from the state to run a business. That's what the libertarians believe, that you should not have to go and get incorporated, quote unquote. Corporations wouldn't exist without the government. Corporations are a creation of government because of the licensing that you have to go and get. So, in a totally free market, you would not have corporations because corporations, as it exists now, would not exist.
Billionaires.
No, well, you just have people creating businesses. That's what you'd
have.
And you'd have more small businesses, I bet, than large businesses.
No, they would crush
large
all the competition that got
major,
in their way.
Big corporations, well, that's what they do now. Big corporations
use
the power of government, but they use their power of incorporation as a hammer against small businesses and competition because big corporations don't like competition.
Libertarians are not using the little guy.
Libertarians stand for small businesses.
Okay,
That's the extent to which
corporations are using government as a hammer is particularly in the corporate copyright and patent laws.
Are you in favor of doing away with copyrights and patents? Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yes, I'm a libertarian, Tom. I'm not some big corporatist Republican.
Okay. There might be some other areas where we would find some agreement.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
How can you say that if somebody invents something, they shouldn't own it? They shouldn't have rights to it?
Well, it depends on what it is that they've invented.
If you read Atlas Shrugged, I mean, the whole essence of this thing was that this guy had invented this new kind of steel.
Well, the Randians,
and he was going
right.
to hold the patent on it. Therefore, he was the only one who controlled it. He wanted to bring it to this railroad, and the railroad said, great, we will try it out, but you know our employees don't want to because the union doesn't want to be the guinea pigs who test this steel. I mean, that all assumed that the patent laws mm-hmm. were in effect.
Well, the problem is the patent laws that we have last way too long now, and I think that if you're going to have one, maybe for 3 years at most would be the best way to do it. But we have to we need innovation. And how can you patent an idea? You know, it's like a chemical formula. If someone comes up with a cure for cancer and they say, oh, we're going to patent this for 20 years or 100 years or something
which they do right now,
which they absolutely do right now, and it's wrong. I should be able to create that chemical compound if I figure out what it is and be able to save more lives. You know, that's the libertarian way. That's the libertarian view. On this.
Here's the problem with what you're saying, Austin. Your libertarian perspective does not account for the public good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has the individual's good in mind. Right, exactly. Your sort criteria mm-hmm. is me, mine. And I would submit to
that the sort criteria
of the founders of this republic was we ours.
Well, it's the idea of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So I get my individual rights,
you also get your individual rights. I got mine, screw you.
Not really, because the economy is not a zero-sum game. Because when I go and I buy something from you, you say thank you, I say thank you. Why? Because we've both benefited. That's how capitalism works.
It's not a zero-sum game.
Politics is a zero-sum game.
Not if you've decided that you're not going to sell me something because I'm black.
Well, wouldn't you rather know that that guy's a racist idiot so that you cannot purchase from that guy? Now the problem is that because of the law, that's a very, very weak argument. No, it's not, because here's the thing. If you know that someone is a racist business owner, then you know not to frequent that establishment.
Right.
That's the best way to do business.
So you want to take us back to 1920 and segregation?
No, that was Woodrow Wilson, your favorite progressive hero that was the big segregationist, if you remember, of course. It was the big racist who said, you know, blacks shouldn't vote for him.
A, Wilson is not my hero. And B, it's not just Wilson. It was everybody prior to the 19th. In any case, Austin Peterson, thelibertarianrepublic.com is the website. Thanks for dropping by, Austin.
Thanks, Tom.
Good to see you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back, 15 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, there's so much stuff going on. This This is quite remarkable. The Moral Monday. Oh, in fact, this is. No, it's not. The Moral Monday groups that are meeting down in North Carolina, in Charlotte. A young man from one of the Moral Monday groups was passing out pamphlets, and they busted him. Right now, this is not a law that's typically enforced, but they nailed this guy for passing out pamphlets about how to register to vote. Really? We're going after people for telling people how to register to vote. The Eric Cantor is cashing in to the tune of $3.4 million. This is pretty remarkable. Eric Cantor lost his primary, as Laura Claussen notes over at Daily Kos, and is going to cash in. He's going to become a vice chairman, a managing director, a member of the board of directors of a boutique investment bank, Moelis and Company. And in his first year, he's looking at $3.4 million. So go to Congress, help out the big corporations for year after year after year. Do that, and the banks will reward you. Yes, the banks will reward you. It's pretty astounding. It's really astounding. Oh, and this is incredible. The Republican Party just tweeted out, on Labor Day, a nice little graphic, you know, suitable for Facebook. A little graphic that says, this Labor Day, this hashtag Labor Day, the White House and Democrats believe paying women less than men is an acceptable practice. And then they sent along the following graphic, which says, all Republicans support equal pay. Right. And then Laura Claussen goes through this list of Republicans who opposed the Paycheck Fairness Act, you know, how Rick Perry opposed a state version of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Republicans filibustered the Paycheck Fairness Act, on and on it goes. So finally, President Obama had to do something about this with an executive order. And now they're talking about impeaching him over that. So it's really quite remarkable. It's really very remarkable. All this stuff that's going on. And after 13 years of fighting for Wall Street, Eric Cantor will make millions at investment bank. That's Josh Israel's headline over at thinkprogress.org. He spent much of his 13 years in the Congress advancing the agenda of Wall Street firms, and now he's going to be a vice chairman of a Wall Street firm. Eric Cantor, back to Eric Cantor. After becoming majority leader in 2011, he vowed to stop the barreling train of Dodd-Frank implementation and push for legislative changes to defang the law. In fact, actually, this is what his Tea Party opponent, who took him down in the primaries, Eric Cantor, attacked him for, was being the lapdog of Wall Street. And his Tea Party opponents said all of the investment banks up in New York and D.C., they should have gone to jail, but instead they went on Eric Cantor's Rolodex and sent him big checks.
Right.
Right. We'll be back. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this. Here with you. Very interesting stuff going on here. Our Facebook page. Somebody sent me an email saying, hey, your Facebook page has porn on it. It's not our Facebook page. And this, I'm scratching my head around this. How do you, because back this on Facebook, there's, you know, I have a private page that just my family members, you know, I just kind of keep track of, we keep track of our kids, but I never use it. I never post to it. I just, you know, watch what they're posting. But we've got we have a Facebook page for this show, and it's fairly easy to find. But back a year or so ago, maybe longer than that, somebody put up a Tom Hartman listeners Facebook page, and we sent off a message to Facebook saying, this is not us. We have nothing to do with this. I believe that this is a violation of our copyrights and trademarks, speaking of those laws and libertarians. And would you please take this page down? And they never replied to us. But I assumed that something had been done about it. I you know, not frequently there. And so apparently somebody is spamming that page. So just FYI, number one, I went over to Facebook. I went over to this page as a Facebook user. And their Facebook's page tells you if somebody is using your content, basically, then you can report this and you by hitting the three little dots. And so I hit the three little dots, and it says, and it says you can fill out this form if they're, you know, using your intellectual property. I tried that, but, you know, the form doesn't come up. And when you try using the form, it says, oh, you're on Facebook. You can't use the phone. So whatever. So if anybody from Facebook is listening, Tom Hartman Listeners is not our site. It's got nothing to do with us. They're using copyrighted images that RT owns. They're using copyrighted images of ours. And it's not our site. Our official site is the Tom Hartman Show site. And so, anyway, those of you who are curious. And I would encourage you, if you actually are a member of the Tom Hartman Listeners site, to post on there that, and you can post on there, to post that Tom is saying, this is not my site, I've got nothing to do with this site. Please let Facebook know that. Okay. So, all of that said, this is why, you know, there's some argument for having either utter chaos or maybe not. I mean, you know, copyright, trademark, patent laws. Oddly enough, I'm with Austin that they should last 3, 4, 5 years maybe, but not this 70-year stuff. It's, you know, when you invent something, whether you're writing a book or whether you're building a better battery, you're standing on the shoulders of other people. There is no way around that. I'm not doing this show or writing the books that I write because I just came up with a brilliant idea. I mean, occasionally, you know, I do, but we all do. But I learned all these things from all these other people, and you pull all this stuff together and you put it down and you say, here. And this was an argument that Jefferson made against copyright, trademark, and patent laws. And an argument that he lost, by the way. Although he never patented any of his inventions, neither did Ben Franklin. And Ben Franklin invented, you know, things that are arguably changed the world, you know, that Ben Franklin was already rich, but that he could have gotten mind-bogglingly rich over had he patented them. Bifocal lenses, the lightning rod, the Franklin stove. I mean, these are three of the major inventions to come out of the late 18th, early 19th centuries. And Franklin could have made so much money on that, but he didn't. So on the one hand. On the other hand, what do you do if somebody takes your image? Don't you have some right to control your own name? Somebody takes your image and creates a phony Facebook page about it, and then somebody else spams it with porn, and then people start saying to you, hey, your Facebook page, you guys have control of it. No, we don't. Somebody set up a phony baloney Facebook page. Anyhow, Jeremy in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hey, Jeremy, you wanted to talk about Austin and libertarians? Austin's not here to defend himself anymore, so let's not personalize this. Let's talk more generally about libertarians.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm driving down the interstate, so I'm going to pull over. But I spoke to several of my friends are libertarians, and that guy represents such a minority of the party. As that article you referenced that I read yesterday on Alternet, they're pretty fractured in what they believe in. And first off, he's not a dumb guy.
But the Libertarian Party, if you look at their presidential platforms, Jeremy, all the things that I just listed are in the platform right now. Libertarian Party is not ambiguous about this.
No, I mean, that's what I'm saying. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I don't think he realizes.
Oh, Austin absolutely knows what he's talking about.
Well, yeah, but I don't think he kind of understands the definition of what libertarianism is. I mean, I think there's a famous quote out there that says about true libertarianism is true anarchy, and that's really what it is. Capitalism in its rawest form really ends up devolving into oligarchies and monopolies. And he thinks that somehow he's supporting, you know, middle class people and small businesses by being a libertarian.
But the reality is that, you know, the libertarians constantly support laissez-faire capitalism. I mean, they're totally in favor of it. So it's a conundrum. Jeremy, thank you for the call. I get it that I think the libertarians are being misrepresented here. Or maybe by Austin. I think not. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Eric Cantor now, $4.3 million paycheck, or is it $3.4 million? In his first year with a new bank, of course. He's a bankster now. It's 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And I am so pleased to have on the air with us, on the line, person who's a real hero of mine, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, U.S. Congresswoman from the 13th District of California. Lee.house.gov is the website. Congresswoman Lee, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, glad to be with you, Tom.
It's been a while since we've talked. And you were, you know, so prescient about Iraq to begin with. What are your thoughts on all this back and forth that's been happening over the last few days in particular about whether we should be reengaging in the Middle East in a big way?
First, let me say it's very important to recognize that ISIS is definitely a very dangerous terrorist organization. And, in fact, I'm very pleased that the president is being very deliberative and very strategic in how he is approaching this potential threat to the United States. Having said that, it's very important to recognize that I supported and others supported the use of military strikes to prevent a terrible genocide from taking place, as well as to protect United States personnel. And so we said limited and targeted strikes to prevent atrocities from taking place we would support. Beyond that, the escalation into a full-scale war troubled myself and others, and we really believe that it's at this point now where the administration needs to come to Congress and lay out what the options are, especially the non-military options, and we need to engage in a debate. Congressman McGovern, Congressman Jones, myself, wrote to the Speaker Boehner and suggested to him that when we come back in September, well, next week, that we need to engage in a debate and a vote if, in fact, this is going to escalate into a full-scale military conflict, because many of us believe this has got to be addressed in a comprehensive way. The president has said over and over again there's no military solution, and so we need to lay out to the public what the options are, how much it's going to cost, and what we're going to do.
And this is what the Constitution requires, too, is that Congress take responsibility for declaring wars.
Absolutely. If we're going to engage, first of all, whether it's ground troops, which the president has said and the Congress has said, no ground troops, no combat troops, but even the 300, 400 military personnel, the use of military hardware, you know, puts our young men and women in danger. And also, when you talk about the trillions of dollars could be at stake in terms of our national treasury, this is very serious, it's very important. And we cannot diminish what this threat is, but we also have to recognize we've got to see this on balance and how we address it in a way that is prudent and that ensures global peace and security.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you. And there's certainly room for a debate here, because you've got now the UN coming out and saying wherever ISIS goes, there are atrocities. And so if we're trying to say, okay, we'll use airstrikes to stop atrocities, one could argue that that would be wherever ISIS goes. On the other hand, there's a strong argument to be made for indigenous people, for local people rising up against their own oppressors, you know, and it gets really...
Well, sure, we have to remember that the Bush policy of preemptive war, the initial bombing of Iraq, you know, created this civil war.
Yeah.
Which the Iraqi people have not recovered from really yet, and they are going to have to be the ones who are going to have a strategy for a political and economic settlement that's going to be inclusive of all Iraqis. This has been a long time in the making, and this is primarily because the United States, you know, in many ways went in with misleading information with regard to weapons of mass destruction. There were none. We knew that. And, in fact, created the chaos now that we are seeing.
Right. I'm curious, as a member of Congress, your thoughts on what happened on what it's still going on. You know, it's the situation in Ferguson, and increasingly we're getting reports from all over the country that, by and large, African Americans get stopped and asked for ID, and if they don't comply, they get beaten up or arrested. And whereas there's lots and lots of video around the internet of these open carry guys being approached by police officers who say, "Who are you?" And they say, "I don't have to tell you." And the cop says, "Oh, okay," and goes away. You know, it's always white guys. And there's a real, you know, it seems like we have a real problem with our police departments not enforcing laws in an equal fashion. Your thoughts on that?
No, anyone who doesn't recognize that there's structural and institutional issues as it relates to racial disparities in policing, they've had their head in the sand. This has been going on. I mean, I raised two young boys in the 70s, you know, and I come from the Bay Area in Oakland. And you have to remember that part of J. Edgar Hoover's plan to annihilate the Black Panther Party was because the Black Panther Party was taking on issues as it relates to police brutality and police misconduct in the African-American community. So this is nothing new. It's a shame and disgrace. And we have to, well, first, of course, diversify the police force. And several of us have called for a police czar. We think that the federal government should really step in now and set some standards and some requirements for policing. But also we've got to deal with the broader issues of institutional racism, of economic disparities, of political empowerment, you know, all of the issues that are have been sort of swept under the rug for many years. You know, these also give rise to what we're seeing, and it's a shame and disgrace. But I think as we, you know, remember and mourn and honor the legacy of Michael Brown and remember Ferguson, we have to remember this is taking place all over the United States. In my community, with Oscar Grant, Trayvon Martin. You know, we could go on and on and on and fight young black men. Also, I raised, as I said, two young black boys. I have two grandsons, and the conversations that we had then and we have now are the same. And I want people to recognize if they don't have to live, you know, we're living under this kind of anxiety and stress. If you have young black boys, African-American men in your family, this is not normal. This is not the American way. This is very abnormal to live constantly ducking and dodging and explaining and telling your kids how to walk appropriately so they don't get stopped and how to address police issues. You know, this is not the norm as the American dream would allow for, if you ask me.
Well, I agree, and I think that the largest, most complicated piece of white privilege, and I say most complicated because I think most white people don't get it, because it's like this is the air they breathe. They don't realize it, or we breathe, speaking as a white guy, is that a white person never wakes up in the morning and says, "Okay, I'm a white person. I wonder how that's going to affect my day to day." A white person, you know, very rarely, probably never in their life, wonders if they lost that job because of their race, if they didn't get that seat in the restaurant because of their race, if that cab driver ignored them because of their race. These are not the, you know, or is that cop, you know, an actual threat to my life who's pulling me over right now, as opposed to just, "Oh, geez, it's an inconvenience."
Race is a factor in everything we do, and until we address issues of racial disparities, institutional racism, and really, quite frankly, the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, segregation, you know, we've got to address these at a very deep level, and until we do, we're not going to be able to really move forward as it relates to seeking liberty and justice for all.
Yeah, completely agree. And when you have people like Bill O'Reilly running around going, "There's no such thing as white privilege," it's like, wait a minute, I want to pull my hair out here.
Yeah.
He's proving my point, I think. But in any case, I don't want to draw you into that.
Yeah.
Anything else before we wrap this up, Congresswoman?
No, I'm pleased to be with you, and I hope the public really recognizes it's going to be public opinion and their members of Congress, as it relates to all of these issues, who are going to weigh in as it relates to public policy, whether it's Syria, Iraq, or police misconduct, criminal justice reform, racism, economic disparities. It's going to be the people who are going to let their members of Congress know through the ballot box what their positions are and what they believe and hold their members of Congress accountable. This election coming up in November is really a defining election, and I hope that the public recognizes that and turns out to vote and votes in a big way to ensure that we move forward and not backwards in our country.
Yeah, yeah. This is a critical junction, a juncture, and this coming election. So often these midterm elections are ignored, but every single member of the House of Representatives is up for re-election, a third of the Senate. This is a big deal, even though the president's not on the ballot.
It's a big deal, and the Voting Rights Act has been rolled back. Voter ID laws are in place, and so, you know, there are those in this country who are trying to stop people of color, low-income people, senior citizens, the disabled. There are many, many trying to stop many constituencies from voting, and we've got to send a strong signal that we are not going to tolerate a rollback of our voting rights and our democratic rights as American citizens to vote. That these obstacles are not going to stop us, but we're going to stop those who are putting forth these obstacles and vote in November, those who support such anti-democratic measures.
Yeah, small-d democratic. Yeah, yeah, absolutely agree. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, okay. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And you can check out Congresswoman Lee's website at lee.house.gov. We'll be back after this break with more here on the Tom Hartman Program. Thanks so much for sticking around. Actually, we'll be picking up your calls right now. There's a lot to get into, including copyrights and trademarks. Oh, Ukraine, I wanted to talk about that. Obviously, ISIS, we got to talk about that. There's just a lot. And libertarians. What are libertarians? What do they know? What do they think they know? Is everything they know wrong?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So you're up next. Stick around. And welcome back. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, you wanted to talk about libertarianism?
Yeah, I'm kind of glad to see that you're paying attention to the movement. I started subscribing to their magazine, Reason, a few years ago. It's an interesting philosophy. I think the problem with libertarians is they're confusing philosophy with a form of government. The first ten amendments to the Constitution are philosophy. It's freedom of the press, freedom to carry guns, freedom, 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 freedom not to be spied on, freedom not to have your papers gone through. That's libertarianism.
So, therefore, we do or don't need more?
It's much like a mixed market economy. We have a mixed philosophy government. We have a little socialism, a little libertarianism. It's good. A little is good for everybody.
See, those things are, once again, Ed, as I said to Austin, those things are sorted in the Constitution and by the framers of the Constitution, sorted in the context of what's the best thing for the United States of America and its citizens, for we the people, in the plural. Libertarians sort those things in the context of what's best for me and mine, because they have this belief that von Mises and Ayn Rand and other philosophers of the movement have articulated very specifically as saying, if most people only look out for themselves and just try to get everything they can for themselves, that will magically work to the benefit of everybody. And there's no evidence that that's the case.
Oh, I know. And that's what the problem with philosophy as opposed to government is. Uh-huh. That was the problem with communism as opposed to socialism.
Right.
When you take philosophy and you let it run wild, you get communism.
Yeah.
And what socialism is a good idea. Just like libertarianism is a good idea in a small dose.
Yeah. Okay. Good point, Ed. Thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. David watching Free Speech TV in Anderson, South Carolina on DirecTV. Hey, David, you wanted to weigh in on libertarianism?
Yeah, I think they seem to be rather naive on human nature by this just presumption that everybody's going to do, the majority's going to do the right thing.
Right.
I had a conversation not too long with a libertarian selling next to me at a local flea market, and he was like, well, the churches will make up for it. And I said, well, obviously none of you guys have suffered long-term unemployment or disability or anything like that, because I said, I've been out of work since most of the time since January. And I said, I've been going around to about every kind of church organization and everything you can think of. And the one organization that did help me got something from the federal government. Right. I said, these places are swamped under. And then there was a couple of places where, quite frankly, they just kind of made it clear they didn't seem to particularly care for me, and they just weren't going to help me anyway. It seemed to be almost a personal thing. But the bottom line is, the one organization that did help me had some federal money behind it.
Right.
And but they seem to be just so, like you said, they might have this attitude that it's just going to fall into place. It is not. They do not know human nature.
Right. I absolutely agree. And they also, the other issue is the potential for anonymity. Libertarianism actually arguably works, just like communism arguably works, in a small community of fewer than 150 people, where everybody knows everybody. And so peer pressure can be brought on the bad actors. But in a country as large and diverse as ours, with no regulation, if you've got somebody who's a bad doctor, yeah, the community will find out about it when they kill somebody, but then they just move someplace else. And now they can start all over again. And that anonymity that is provided by the large nation, it causes libertarianism to just collapse. David, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. I'm Armin here with you 10 minutes before the hour. Mark in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Mark, you're on the air. You want to talk about libertarianism?
Conservatives and libertarians to work together.
I beg your pardon?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air, Mark.
Oh, hi, Tom. I'm sorry, I was talking to myself. look, I'm reading the book Unstoppable by Ralph Nader, and he makes an elegant case for libertarians, conservatives, and liberals, progressives, working together on procedural issues. But one of the things that maybe you can clear up for me, because you talk to these people more than I do, and I have a couple of libertarian friends who spout great theory.
Right.
But I don't see any procedural reality from these people. It's like they keep pointing out Switzerland as this libertarian haven, but Switzerland has socialized medicine.
Actually, they don't.
I don't understand how they plan to get around this stuff.
Switzerland does not have socialized medicine. It's one of the exceptions in Europe, and it doesn't have single-payer medicine. The way the Swiss did it is they said that everybody must have insurance, and the insurance can only be provided by not-for-profit companies. And if you're going to run a hospital or other medical-related business in Switzerland, you have to be a not-for-profit if you directly interact with consumers. And so the result of that is by stripping the profit motive out of healthcare and mandating it by government policy, which is not at all libertarian. Switzerland has a fairly good it's a small country too. It has a fairly good network of healthcare. It's among the best in the world, but it's government mandated as opposed to government run. The UK's is government run.
Do you understand how these people, is there any clue as to how they would make this libertarian utopia happen in this country? Because I don't see how they can make it happen.
Well, the way you make it happen is the way you make it happen is you destroy all these federal agencies. You get the federal government out of everybody's business, and then you let the states and the local communities go back to discriminating against whoever they want, and poor communities have poor education. Actually, nobody has any education unless they've got money. And the wealthy people will do really well. And it basically takes us back to Charles Dickens' England, back to, through 250 years ago. And
I've lived in Mexico, where a small number of people own everything.
Right.
And if that's where Americans want to live, they should go try it out.
Yeah. Well, that's my point about Somalia. I call Somalia the libertarian paradise. Basically, the government does nothing but run the military and the police, which is what libertarians argue for. And, the consequence of that is, hey, it's Somalia. Do you want to live there? Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Josh in Algona, Iowa. Hey, Josh, you wanted to talk about Ukraine?
Yeah, hey, Tom. Good to talk with you as always. There was an article by Wesley Clark in The Guardian this week, and I found it very interesting. He was talking that there isn't a military solution, of course, but he was talking about arming the Ukrainian army.
Right.
And I wanted to get your thoughts on that. I mean, Angela Merkel also came out this weekend and said that there is no military solution, that we should impose greater sanctions. I don't see the sanctions working at the moment.
Right.
I mean, what's your solution for the problem, and what do you think about Wesley Clark's comments?
I don't think it's our problem. And if you go back to when the Soviet Union was unraveling, the deal that George Herbert Walker Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev made was that NATO would never apply. No country that bordered Russia could ever apply to NATO for NATO status, because Russia wanted to have a buffer between itself and Western Europe. And particularly if they're going to let down the guard of being the Soviet Union, right? If they're going to, you know, free all these countries. And now NATO has gone into Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. And Estonia actually shares a border with Russia. And the president, our president, is, I believe, today in Estonia. You can, somebody needs to double check this, but I believe he's there or he's going there. And I think that that's just a really dangerous thing. And the same with Ukraine. Ukraine was, you know, the deal was never NATO. And now NATO is talking about, well, let's create a 4,000-man force and let's make it available to these countries. And it sounds to me like it's just a very provocative thing. I think it's a bad policy. I don't think that Putin is Hitler, and I don't think that this is the Sudetenland, you know, that he's taking. I think that there are, you know, longstanding regional oddities, or whatever you want to call it, you know, that come out of the way that the Soviet Union dissolved and the way that Ukraine was formed. And one of the most important being that Ukraine was not created, the modern Ukraine is not a federalist society. The local states and local city governments do not elect, if you live in these areas, you do not elect your own representatives. They're appointed by the central government in Kiev. And this is what the so-called separatists have been fighting about, is they've been saying, you know, we want to have our own local governments. And then the government in Kiev, this new government that we helped install, starts bombing them, bombing their cities. And we're supporting the government that's bombing their people. I don't get it.
So here, just hypothetical. I know we don't like hypotheticals, but what would happen if Russia keeps creeping, and all of a sudden takes over Ukraine? Does the United States not have any interest in helping the Ukrainians?
I don't think we do, frankly. And nor do we have arguably any interest in helping. I mean, fill in the blank. There's probably 70 or 80 or 90 countries around the world that are in distress and that are having conflicts with their neighbors right now. You know, why do we need to insert ourselves into all of these things? It's not our business. The only interest that I know of that the U.S. has in Ukraine is that about 5-6 years ago, it was discovered that Ukraine is sitting on this huge patch of Marcellus shale. And Ukraine may have as much as 20% of all the natural gas in Europe that could be fracked out. And none of it's been taken out. It's virgin territory. So there's lots and lots and lots of natural gas and oil that can be pulled out of the ground in Ukraine. And Chevron, the American company, went in and signed a multi-billion, I think it was a $10 billion deal with the Ukrainian government a year or so ago. Bloomberg reported on this. And that fact seems to slip through the discussion points. It never gets mentioned on radio or television that this might be another oil war. You know, it's like just like Dick Cheney said, you know, Iraq has 10% of the world's oil, very inexpensive oil. You know, it's very important.
That's a good point, Tom.
And now Ukraine has got 20% of the oil and natural gas in Europe, and suddenly there's a conflict about Ukraine. Surprise! That's not my problem. Josh, thanks a lot for the call. It's definitely not my problem if we're talking about nuclear war. We'll be back. It is about 2 minutes before the hour. And, well, we've got a guest for the third hour. But next hour, I have some things I want to share. And we'll pick up your call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, by the way, Germans addicted to eating. This is fascinating. Over at The Guardian, Yvonne Roberts writing, a number of German companies, apparently Volkswagen and was it BMW, I think, are going to do this. Daimler has started it. No, it's Volkswagen and Deutsche Telekom have done this as well. And this is that when you're gone from work and somebody sends you an email, the email automatically replies saying, sorry, this person's not here at work. They're on holiday or it's evening or whatever. And this email is being referred to somebody who is working right now. These are companies that maintain 24-hour offices. And that it forwards it to that person, and then it deletes it. So the person doesn't see it when they come in on Monday, you know, and or Tuesday if it's a long holiday like this. And this is fascinating. Is it time to, are we addicted to our email? I find that, you know, I'm checking my email like every hour, every 2 hours. It's like, what's that about? I mean, I used to get mail once a day. I realize I'm sounding like, back in my day. But I think that there is something really smart about saying, you know, let's have some hygiene with regard to our online lives, our online habits. Whether it's, you know, checking your work site every day or every hour or checking your website every hour or checking your, I mean, you know, fill in the blanks, your Facebook page, your email. Is it time to just take a break? Hey, let it rest. I think that would be a very good idea. We talked about ISIS in the previous hour briefly. I just want to make a couple of points here that are, I think, really important to make. Whether we're talking about Hamas or Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or the ISIS, the Islamic State, or Boko Haram, the one thing that all of these fundamentalist Muslim groups, and then you can toss in the right-wing Christians in the United States and around the world, the one thing that these people agree on is that women are second-class citizens. That's at the core of their activity and philosophy. And this, you know, in Islam, this comes out of this Salafi worldview, which is the Muslim equivalent of, you know, right-wing conservative Christianity. And that has been promoted by Saudi Arabia for, yeah, arguably since before the United States was a republic. Steve Clemens writing over at The Atlantic, thank God for the Saudis and Prince Bandar, John McCain told CNN's Candy Crowley back in January. Thank God for the Saudis and Prince Bandar and for our Qatari friends. What he's talking about is that these, at the request of John McCain and Lindsey Graham, Prince Bandar got involved in giving a bunch of money and a bunch of weapons to a bunch of anti-Bashar al-Assad, you know, the guy who runs Syria, a bunch of anti-Syrian government rebels. Those people that were supported by Saudi Arabia, well, this is to quote Steve Clemens in The Atlantic, the two of the most successful factions fighting Assad's forces are Islamic extremist groups, Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, the latter of which is now amassing territory in Iraq and threatening to further destabilize the region. And then he says, ISIS, in fact, may have been a major part of Bandar's covert ops strategy in Syria. The Saudi government, for its part, has denied allegations, including claims made by Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, that it directly supported ISIS. And, you know, it just goes through this. It gets very interesting. And then this led to a piece by Ed Hussein on August 22nd in the New York Times titled, Saudis Must Stop Exporting Extremism. And Ed writes, let's be clear. Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, Boko Haram, the Shabab, and others are all violent Sunni Salafi groups. For 5 decades, Saudi Arabia has been the official sponsor of Sunni Salafism across the globe. And it was Sunni Salafis who took down the towers in 9/11. And, you know, again, they only represent 3% of the world's Muslims. It's a very, very tiny minority within Islam, just like fundamentalist Christianity is a very tiny minority within Christianity. Although, well, and then it goes on to say they've been lavishly supported by the Saudi government, which has appointed emissaries to its embassies in Muslim countries who proselytize for Salafism. And Saudi Arabia is a Salafi country. He points out just since August 4th, 19 people have been beheaded in Saudi Arabia, half of them, nearly half of them, for nonviolent crimes. And then you wonder why Salafi groups like ISIS are beheading people. Well, it's because they're sponsors. Saudi Arabia does. They're patron. He notes the textbooks in the New York Times, Ed Hussein notes, textbooks in Saudi Arabia's schools and universities teach this brand of Islam. If ISIS is detonating shrines, it learned to do so from the precedent set in 1925 by the House of Saud with the Wahhabi-inspired demolition of 1,400-year-old tombs in the Jannat al-Baqi cemetery in Medina. See, ISIS is opposed to tombstones because these are graven images. Can't have tombstones with Salafi Islam, just like, you know, fundamentalist Baptists can't dance. People say, well, fundamentalist Christians were never that, you know, evil and destructive. Not quite the case. Go back and read the history of the Puritans and the Pilgrims when they came to North America back in the 1600s and how enthusiastically they were involved in killing Native Americans and calling it God's work. Granted, modern fundamentalist Christians are not so much, although it's the fundamentalist Christians in Uganda who are saying, hey, kill the gays. So, I'm just saying, it's time for us to wake up. Interesting piece over at DU back a couple days ago, Mr. Scorpio posted, Georgia police used taser like a cattle prod to force black man to walk until he died. And again, it's not hard to find video of police interacting with, well, like at the Clive and Bundy Ranch, with white people with guns. And when police interact with white people with guns, they get real polite. When they interact with black people who are unarmed, slap them down. Eric Cantor is taking his $3-plus million paycheck and running. Meanwhile, the Republicans continue to filibuster pretty much everything. Oh, over the weekend. This was a big story. Mitch McConnell complained to a room full of billionaires. This is reported over at thenation.com. These are secret audio recordings. And Lauren Windsor writes over at The Nation that these are the things that Mitch McConnell said. He said, and I quote, so in the House and Senate, we own the budget. So what does that mean? That means that we can pass the spending bill. And I assure you that in the spending bill, we will be pushing back against this bureaucracy by doing what's called placing riders in the bill. No money can be spent to do this or do that. We're going to go after them on health care, on financial services, on the Environmental Protection Agency, across the board, all across the federal government. We're going to go after it.
Really?
On the Democrats, Mitch McConnell told the Koch brothers, they're frightened of their critics. They don't want to join the tradition in open discourse. They want to use the power of the government to quiet the voices of their critics. Right. McConnell, who led 67 filibusters in 2012. More than the total number of filibusters in the 54 years from 1917 to 1970. He said, so all Citizens United did was level a playing field for corporate speech. We now have, I think, the most free and open system we've had in modern times. This is Mitch McConnell at the Koch Brothers Conference, basically saying to the Koch Brothers, thank you, guys. You're making the Republican Party happen all around the country.
Yep.
15 minutes past the hour. Your calls are up.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And this Pew poll, libertarians don't know what libertarians mean. Fascinating. Welcome back. Alan in Muskegon, Michigan. Hey, Alan, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You wanted to talk about libertarianism and McCutcheon?
Yeah, well, it occurred to me that, and it ties in with a story I saw in the Washington Post today where 310 billionaires have, or I think, yeah, 300 billionaires have already contributed $11.5 million to various campaigns around the country, and many of them are proudly talking about how they have spread their money around to individual House and Senate races.
Right, which McCutcheon allows them to
me, there's unlimited money, and the fact that these same people also have control over the major media. We have unlimited money, but the major media have limited airtime.
Right.
And there's absolutely nothing I can think of that would limit their ability to literally buy up all the airtime in the country, or at least a sufficient amount in every congressional district to take over the government and monopolize all of the political airtime.
Alan, this is actually the Republican strategy, and it's being played out right now in Florida, where the Rick Scott campaign, Rick Scott himself being a multimillionaire, he was the head of a company that defrauded Medicare, the largest Medicare, Medicaid fraud in the history of the United States. And he left that company with $70 million in his pocket, I guess, and has largely funded his own campaigns. But he's got a bunch of other millionaires and billionaires with him, basically a corporate criminal. Running for re-election, and Charlie Crist is challenging him, the Republican-turned-Democrat who is just disgusted by this whole thing. He's been on this program. And the Crist campaign's biggest challenge right now is that the Rick Scott campaign has already bought up most of the ad time that's available on television between now and November. And so, you know, if you can't get on television to make your pitch, you're screwed. And this is what Rick Scott is depending on to make him governor, you know, for another term.
One more step towards get everybody screwed.
Yeah, yeah. And
how about the fact that they're trying to kill the post office?
Yeah. Well, this has long been a
thing. The last way of getting direct contact with voters, they're also buying up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, I hadn't even thought of that. But yes, the two ways to contact voters in a big way directly are through the mail. And, in fact, direct mail was, turned into an art form by Republicans back in the 1980s, and via radio and television. And if you own all of, you know, the radio and television, and this is one of the reasons, by the way, all that money is going, this is one of the reasons you will not hear about this in mainstream news reports on American electronic media and radio or television. You will not hear about these issues of campaign finance and you won't hear an honest discussion about it because all that money goes to them. You know, yeah. when the Koch brothers come in and say, okay, here's $100 million that we're throwing into the state of such and such, that $100 million, you know, 95 of it is going to end up, 95 million of it is going to end up in the pockets of the media in that state. So are the media going to complain about this? I don't think so. I mean, they're loving this. So it's you're right, Alan. This is a real problem. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It is 20 minutes past the hour. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bill in Fontana, California. It says here, you want to challenge me about Rand Paul?
Yeah.
So you're on the air, Bill. Go for it.
You and a number of people always seem to be saying that he said he would vote against the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
No, I said his father did. I pointed out that Rand Paul has not been that inartful. He has always waffled on that question and rarely given a direct answer, but his father not only had explicitly, Ron Paul said he would have voted against it, but when about a decade ago a resolution came before Congress on the anniversary of the Voting Rights Act to say, yes, we would all vote for this again. It was a wonderful piece of legislation. It sailed through in a bipartisan vote in both houses, but Ron Paul voted against it.
Okay. Yeah, I know I happen to be listening to Rachel Maddow show when he was on there, and I know Rand Paul was very
he's very careful. This is what I said to Austin. His dad was a cameo candidate for president. He wasn't a serious candidate for president. Rand Paul is a serious candidate for president, and he's demonstrating it by this level of sophistication, knowing that if he were to say out loud what he actually believes, that it would hurt him with the electorate. So he doesn't say it out loud. His father would say it bluntly out loud. And, you know, I think that that's one of the reasons why there's a 5 or 10% chance that Rand Paul is going to be the Republican nominee, and there's a much higher chance that he's going to play a major role in shaping the Republican campaign and debate.
Well, I don't know that. I think you might be wrong about that. I think he would be a very good candidate for the Republicans in the general, but I don't think he'll get through the primaries.
That's interesting. I think he would fall down in the general, but he might make it in the primaries. But I don't know. You know, time is going to have to tell, Bill. Because it's like there are some positions that Rand Paul is taking, his anti-interventionist position, that I think is not. This is not a libertarian position or a liberal position or a conservative position. It's just a position on an issue that has been shared by both parties at various times and both parts of the political spectrum at various times over the last 150 years. And, you know, his stand on the NSA and things like that. I mean, these are the areas that Ralph Nader talks about where liberals and libertarians have essentially the same position and should join forces and just, you know, ignore the old categories of Republican and Democrat create a social movement,
which is why I think he would do a very good run in the particularly against Hillary Clinton in the general.
I don't disagree. I think that Rand Paul would give Hillary Clinton a run for her money. I think he would also, though, at the same time give the Republican Party's institutional power structure a run for their money, and that's going to be problematic. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Kathy in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Kathy, you want to talk about libertarianism?
Yes, I'd like to talk about several things. And
you need to pick up your phone, Kathy. Can't talk on a speaker.
Okay. One of them is that you can tell me if I'm right or wrong.
Kathy, I'm having a hard time hearing you. I need you to take your phone off speakerphone and put it up to your head.
Oh, sorry. I haven't heard any of the libertarians during the time that we were bombarded with all of the demeaning laws that were affecting women, the invasive ultrasound, everything else. I mean, everything. It was a bombardment that was coming out of Alex. I didn't hear the libertarians speaking up for women during that time in any strong way at all.
No, Rand Paul is on the record as being, quote, pro-life, end quote. So he presumably would support these kinds of laws.
Exactly. So it's like, don't tell me about being a libertarian until you are a libertarian for women. And that's why I don't think he'd have a chance against Hillary, because women are going to be out in force in this next election.
Yeah, I'm with you. Libertarians want to shrink. Apparently, Rand Paul wants to shrink government down to the size where it can fit in a woman's uterus. I mean, this, you know, they're perfectly willing to insert government into a woman's reproductive choices, not so much into whether or not a business can, you know, discriminate against people of another race. It's absolutely bizarre. Kathy, thank you for your call. Billy in Wimberley, Texas. Hey, Billy, you want to tell me that Christians, the Pat Robertson has nothing to do with radical Islam when it comes to women? Seriously?
Seriously. Christians, I've been a Catholic all my life, and Christians in general, or all Christians, should revere women.
Revere?
Not any more than men, not any less, but there's certainly no war like what goes on in Saudi Arabia or even in your own leftist culture, where it's okay to soil a woman by letting her just tear a baby out of her womb. You know, I mean, I'm tired of this, and I'm tired of the lie that Christians and conservatives in general hate women, and there's a war on women. That's false. And
but you want to tell a woman whether or not she can have an abortion?
Well, that's what you all always bring up.
Well, no, that's what you just brought up.
Women subservient, because we don't agree with abortion on demand.
Right. So you think that
abortion on demand is just flat wrong. Most of us can agree that in the cases of rape, incest, or the immediate health of the women, that abortion is something that should be considered.
Don't you think that this is not the role of government, Billy? If you want to be conservative, isn't the conservative position that this should be between a woman, her doctor, and arguably her priest and partner?
Well, the Christians don't make the laws. The lawmakers make the laws. But we vote for people that are going to respect life and that is far flung from being a war against women.
So a living woman who is a couple of weeks pregnant and doesn't want to be, and who has a piece of tissue in her uterus that's, you know, smaller than the size of a dime, arguably so, smaller than the size of the head of an eraser on a pencil, she is not as, her life is not as important as that little blob of cells inside her?
We're not talking about taking her life, though, Tom.
Actually, you are. The probability of dying in childbirth is much higher than the probability of dying from an abortion.
That's ridiculous. Well,
no, it's not ridiculous. Women die in childbirth all the time. It's a really serious risk of pregnancy. Billy, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Breaking news, ISIS has beheaded a second American, Stephen Sotloff. The pressure on President Obama will be ratcheted up now, by the way. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. CNN and others, pretty much every network is now reporting, all the news sites reporting that Stephen Sotloff, the second American, I believe he's a reporter as well, has been beheaded by ISIS. They've released another video, another grisly video. This is just like, this sucks. And what sucks about it most is that this is exactly what Osama bin Laden predicted. You know, we did this show, a week or two ago? I should have, during the break, I was otherwise occupied, but I should have dug out my copy of the old, this is what Osama bin Laden had to say, riff. I did this last week on this show. Bin Laden said, we're going to bleed you dry. This is back in 1998. He said, we're going to bleed you dry. We're going to hit you. Actually, in 2004, no, it's Obama, it's bin Laden's video that was released in November of 2004, just before the elections. And he says, and I think, who knows what he thought in terms of American politics. He said the Bush administration is stupid, that, all we have to do is have an Al-Qaeda member go to the farthest corner of the earth and wave a piece of cloth with the name Al-Qaeda on it, and Bush will, run across the earth and spend billions of dollars and lots of American blood to go after that guy. And, he's basically trashing Bush, which actually helped Bush in the election, or at least this is conventional wisdom, that caused people to vote for Bush thinking that, well, if bin Laden hates him, then I should too. And bin Laden wasn't saying that he hated him. He was saying that he loved him. Bush does exactly what bin Laden wanted. And these Salafis, ISIS, the Salafi Muslims, they're this tiny sliver within Islam that is so, outspoken about it. Yeah, thank you, Shano. The Arab Language Network Al Jazeera released a full transcript. This is back in 2004. We are continuing this policy. This is Osama bin Laden speaking. We are continuing this policy in bleeding America to the point of bankruptcy. Allah willing, and nothing is too great for Allah. He said that they did the same thing to the Soviet Union in the 1980s, quote, using guerrilla warfare and the war of attrition to fight tyrannical superpowers. We, alongside the Mujahideen, bled Russia for 10 years until it went bankrupt and was forced to withdraw in defeat, bin Laden said. He said that Al-Qaeda has found it, quote, easy for us to provoke and bait this administration. George Bush. All we have to do is send two Mujahideen to the farthest point to raise a piece of cloth on which is written Al-Qaeda in order to make generals race there to cause Americans to suffer human, economic, and political losses without achieving anything of note other than some benefits for their private corporations. Quote, unquote, Osama bin Laden. He said every dollar, this is bin Laden once again, he's talking about 9/11. He says every dollar of Al-Qaeda defeated $1 million by the permission of Allah, besides the loss of a huge number of jobs. As for the economic deficit, it has reached record astronomical numbers, estimated to total more than $1 trillion. It is true that this shows that Al-Qaeda has gained, But on the other hand, it shows that the Bush administration has also gained something that anyone who looks at the size of the contracts acquired by the shady Bush administration-linked mega corporations like Halliburton and its kind will be convinced. It all shows, I'm quoting Osama bin Laden, it all shows that the real loser is you. It is the American people and your economy. The darkness of black gold, speaking of Bush, he says the darkness of black gold blurred his vision and insight, and he gave priority to private interests over the public interests of America. So the war went ahead, the death toll rose, the American economy bled, and Bush became embroiled in the swamps of Iraq that threaten his future. Osama bin Laden saying this. When are we going to wake up? Randy in Ottawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Wow. You touched on that Press Bandauer and ISIS. And, you know, it just clicked. This takes me right back to Iran-Contra and the Republicans and the neocons looking for a slush fund, a way to promote their agenda with war and force overseas.
Right, in Central America.
And, right, and there's got to be a line, a logic that runs through here. And for John McCain to be doing this in the year 2014, it's beyond me, sir.
Yeah. I agree.
I just wanted to, and oh, can I make one more comment?
Sure.
On Paul, oh God, what's his name? The candidate.
Rand Paul.
Paul.
Yeah.
As far as being a plagiarist, I'm not sure how anybody could really take him serious as a candidate, either in the primaries or the election itself.
Yeah. I'm not sure that his I don't know. Now that I'm thinking back on it, wasn't he charged with plagiarizing Wikipedia stuff for things beyond just his campaign stuff, for things like, you know, a college paper or something? Or am I thinking of somebody else?
That's correct. And, yeah, and it's been a competitive thing with him. It's not just one incident.
Yeah.
So
very, very interesting. Randy, thanks a lot for the call. I don't disagree. We'll see how this plays out. Patricia in Northampton, Massachusetts. Hey, Patricia, you wanted to respond to Billy in Texas about abortion?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment that although the maternal risk of death in this country is much higher than other wealthy countries, the real risk to having an unwanted child is poverty for the mother and poverty for the children, and just a lack of an ability for women to move forward in their lives. And, you know, one pregnancy usually leads to another pregnancy, and women get saddled down with taking care of a lot of children, and then she ends up in her later years with no way to support herself.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent point. Excellent point. And this is, you know, quite literally a war against women. I mean, I don't know how to describe it beyond that. Patricia, thanks for the call. Gary in Terre Haute, Indiana. Hey, Gary.
Yeah. Hey, Tom. Your guest that you had on at the beginning of the show, I can't remember his name.
An hour ago, Austin Peterson, the libertarian?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was on your show, not on the phone here.
That's right. He was on the show.
Okay. Well, I believe he was disingenuous. I believe he was hiding his ism, whatever you want to put in it, racism, sexism, as religious liberty.
Or just liberty, period.
He was hiding behind that.
Yeah. I don't think he was hiding. I think he was pretty, you know, Austin's not here to defend himself, and I don't think that we should sit around and pick on him. But in general, libertarians will tell you, you know, yes, it may be that our policies will return us to days of legal segregation. But, you know, if you don't like that, if enough people don't like that, the marketplace will correct it. They think somehow the marketplace is magically self-correcting. And
I think that was the guise, was religious liberty.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Actually, yeah, you're right. I brought that up, and I said, you know, if my religion doesn't, as you know, Mormons didn't acknowledge black people as fully human until the 70s or 80s. I think it was 87. But yeah, good point, Gary. Thank you for the call, Davis in Radford, Virginia. You wanted to, we're back to libertarianism.
Yeah, Tom. Say, I was here listening to about how the libertarians, they want to not have the government involved in anything that it doesn't need to. And we have to take them at their word. If they say that, well, then let's point out to them that there's things that the government has to be involved in, not just needs to. Things to which I've heard called commons, things that are common to all people.
Right.
Things that, like food, air, water, housing, health, education, police, military, all of these things.
Fire department.
When they're ran by the government, people that run the government are answerable to the vote.
Right.
And if it isn't run by the government, big business fills the vacuum, and they're answerable to stockholders.
Right, which is a whole different group of people. You're absolutely right, Davis, and that's the key to the whole thing that most Americans miss. Thank you very much for calling and sharing that. Jody in Lexington, Kentucky. Jody, we got just a minute here until the break. Quick one.
Yes, sir. If anybody ever tells you that they are a conservative Christian, they have lied to you about one thing or the other. They're either not conservative or they are not Christian. The two do not go together. Jesus was the biggest liberal of all time. And if they would read Exodus chapter 21, verse 22, and fully understand all the ramifications of that verse, they would never again question whether abortion is A, sin, or B, murder.
Huh. Because Exodus says what?
It says two men are fighting. One of them has a pregnant woman. The woman gets in the middle of the fight. The second man hits her and causes her to miscarry.
Right.
The fine, with which he's got to pay a fine to the
right.
woman's husband.
Right.
To be determined by the woman's husband. He can appeal that to the elders, and they can reduce the fine. But
right.
if he kills the woman, then he must give a life for a life, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth.
Yeah.
Why not if he kills the fetus?
There you
go. Not a life.
Okay. Jody, thanks a lot for the info. I've now, in retrospect, I'm familiar with that Bible verse. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And your calls coming up next here on the Tom Hartman Program. 15 minutes before you. And welcome back. Dennis watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Tampa, Florida. You are on the air, Dennis.
Hi, Tom. I guess first, all thoughts to the Sotloff family. That's horrible.
Yeah.
The guy that called about abortion, when he said you're going to allow a woman to defile herself by letting her have an abortion, he didn't see it. It was right there. I mean, you don't allow
and let
a woman to do anything.
Right. Allow and let assumes that you have the power over her.
Exactly. I mean, they just don't see it. You cannot assume control over a woman. That's where your argument falls wrong. It just amazes me how they cannot see that.
Well, this is, you know, what he's calling for is the coercion of the state, which is anti-libertarian, I guess. And it's just, yeah, I'm with you. Thanks a lot for the call, Dennis. Well said. Liz in Halethorpe, Maryland. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Hey, Liz. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Saying that right. How you doing?
Good.
I like your show.
Thanks. Thanks for watching Dish Network. And
yeah,
you wanted to say?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about, actually, you made a comment about the way police treated the militia individuals down at the Bundy Ranch versus how they treated, I guess, the protesters and the Ferguson residents. You know, that happened.
Or doesn't. I mean, there's just this last week, a new video went up of an African-American guy who was just sitting waiting for his kids, you know, to get out of school. And the police came up to him and said, you know, show us some ID. Tell us who you are. And he said, I don't have to tell you. I'm not committing a crime. I'm just waiting for my kids. And they arrested him on camera. And as opposed to when the police go up to a white guy and say, let me see your ID, as they do frequently at these open carry things. And the white guy says, you know, I don't have to tell you. And the police say, okay, all right, and they go away. I mean, we got video of that.
Yeah, but you know, you're right about that. It goes on every day in the black community. They harass, and that never is talked about. I mean, it's general harassment every day, not the killings or the beatings, but just general harassment in the black community. But I also wanted to speak about, what do you think about the military, all this artillery that they were using against the Ferguson residents, you know, the M16s, the Humvees.
Yeah, the MRAP, 22-ton tanks, you know, armored tanks. I think it's crazy. And I think it's crazy that we ever got the military-industrial complex into our police departments. I think it's going to take us a long time to get them out. Now you've got TV shows where the cops are running around, you know, with elbow pads and knee pads and, you know, armor and all this, you know, and all this stuff. And it's like, this has become the new normal. And it's pretty startling. It's really startling. In fact, I'm going to riff on this in just a minute about having watched the movie Watermelon Man over the weekend and how different the police were in 1970 when that movie was made and how they are today, even in the way that they were treating African Americans. Pretty astounding. Liz, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes. Hours a day, 5 days a week, right here, Tom Hartman with you, and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com, and free-don.org is on the line with us. Victoria, the beheading of Steve Sotloff has been confirmed?
It has not been confirmed, but the Site Intelligence Group, which is a research organization that tracks jihadist web postings, has said that the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria has beheaded Stephen Sotloff, who is a freelance journalist who freelanced for Time and Foreign Policy magazines. They posted a video of it on the internet. Josh Earnest, I just came from the briefing in the White House, said that obviously their analysts will review any video very carefully and will give their analysis. In the video distributed today, which was entitled A Second Message to America, Sotloff appears in a similar orange jumpsuit to his one of 2 weeks ago before he's beheaded by what appears to be the same Islamic State fighter as the previous one who executed or appeared to execute James Foley. And in this video, Sotloff describes himself as, quote, paying the price, unquote, for the Obama administration's decision to strike ISIS targets in Iraq. And the masked fighter with the English accent says, I'm back, Obama, and I'm back because of your arrogant foreign policy towards the Islamic State. Now, the Site group says that ISIS is threatening a third captive, a Briton, who it identifies as David Cawthorne Haynes, as the next beheading victim. And ISIS is believed to be holding at least two other Americans.
Right, and they will get as many as they can. In this op-ed for the New York Times, written by Ed Hussein on August 22nd, titled Saudis Must Stop Exporting Extremism, he says, just since August 4, 19 people have been beheaded in Saudi Arabia, nearly half for nonviolent crimes. He said, we overlook the public executions by the beheading permitted by Saudi Arabia, but by licensing such barbarity, the kingdom normalizes and indirectly encourages such punishments elsewhere. Is there any discussion about Saudi Arabia's role in this or the role of John McCain and Lindsey Graham in getting Prince Bandar to fund this ISIS group as an anti-Assad group?
I don't think there is. I haven't heard discussion of McCain and Graham getting them to fund it. There was a very interesting piece that I would commend to you last week in the Wall Street Journal, if you have a subscription, about how Bashar al-Assad who a lot of people are saying, oh, well, he's against ISIS, basically was a very big part of the reason why ISIS was able to come into being.
Right.
Very interesting sort of think piece.
Yeah, there's an Atlantic piece that was written by Steve Clemens, and I'm not sure when this was published. It looks like June of this year. Thank God for the Saudis and Prince Bandar, John McCain told CNN's Candy Crowley. Thank God for the Saudis and Prince Bandar and our Qatari friends. You know, basically for funding these fundamentalists, Salafi Sunnis in Syria. But, you know.
Well, I mean, one of the challenges, I mean, President Obama wants to put together an international coalition, which makes a lot of sense. But one of the challenges is that you could put together an international coalition which must include Arab states, otherwise an international coalition is not going to work, but you could have Arab states who say that they are on board, and at the same time, either the state or ministers within the government, wealthy ministers within the government, or extremely wealthy individuals within with power within that country are at the same time funding ISIS.
And there seems to be little doubt that this is happening in the Middle East.
And the European governments have been funding ISIS by paying ransom.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely right.
It's very complicated.
Yeah, it is. And then you get I'm sure you remember the November 2004 video from Osama bin Laden in which he said basically, you know, I yell jump and Bush yells how high. You know, all we have to, we're going to bleed America dry, and this is how we're going to do it. And it's just like, you know, it's like clickbait. I mean, you know, these guys are just saying, come on, you know, take us on. We want to have a fight here. Come on over here. Have a fight with us. Please.
Yes.
Yeah. Throw us in that briar patch.
It's a question of who has the strategy and who has the tactics.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that up until this point, Obama has been able to resist the siren song or the pressure or both to go to war in the Middle East to some extent anyway. I don't know how this is going to play out. What else is going on in the world?
Well, an airstrike in Somalia by U.S. armed forces targeted the leader of the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab, Ahmed Abdi Godan, Somalian U.S. officials said today, but it's unclear whether he was killed in the attack. It's believed that six militants were killed. One U.S. official said to Reuters, "We don't know that he's dead, but he was the target." Now, Godan is pretty nasty guy. He's restyled the group as a global player in the Al-Qaeda franchise, and he's believed to be the mastermind behind the attack on a Kenyan shopping mall in September last year that in which 67 people were killed. They've also carried out guerrilla attacks in Mogadishu as well as in neighboring Kenya and Uganda. They are very, very, very nasty.
So this is Al-Qaeda in East Africa.
Yes, Al-Shabaab.
Al-Shabaab
in Somalia. They're like a franchise, if you like, but they are very nasty, and they, whether they have designs specifically on America, Josh Earnest today said that they have designs on American interests.
Right. Not good.
Ukrainian officials said today that Russian forces have been spotted in both of the major rebel-held cities in eastern Ukraine, that's Donetsk and Luhansk. This is a claim by Colonel Andriy Lysenko, a spokesman for Ukraine's National Security Council, coming as the defense minister said Ukraine's armed forces are expanding their strategy from just fighting separatist rebels to facing the Russian army in a war that could cost, quote, tens of thousands of lives.
Oh, my God. Can you spell World War One? Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Slowly getting your piece to bed. Stephen Sotloff, the freelance reporter for Time Magazine and others, has apparently been beheaded. It's fairly well confirmed now by ISIS in Iraq, presumably. And we will get back to that topic in just a moment. But another topic that is of some considerable consequence is sea level rise and climate change. And Dr. Sally Brown, research fellow in engineering and the environment at the University of Southampton in the UK, is with us. The website southampton.ac.uk. And Dr. Brown, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hello.
Thank you for joining us. What do we need to do? First of all, what are we anticipating in terms of sea level rise around the world?
Okay, first of all, sea level rise is quite a complex science to study, and scientists have a whole range of potential scenarios of sea level rise. They think maybe an upper estimate could be around about a meter per century. So I guess in American terms, that's just over 3 foot. But there could be variation. We would expect some parts of the world to see a little bit more sea level rise than that, some parts a little bit less.
Mm-hmm. And what are countries around the world doing to prepare for this?
Very different, really. Many of the developing countries, such as around Europe and certainly in the UK, are very prepared for climate change. So in terms of sea level rise, they're thinking ahead. They're thinking about how much sea level rise that could be. And so when they're building new structures on the coast, they're actually trying to factor that into their measurements to make sure that, say, for example, with ports such as the London Gateway, that they make the port high enough for sea level rise over the next century. Other countries aren't doing so much, perhaps because they don't want to, they can't afford to, or they're just not aware of the problem.
The United States.
Yes, there's quite a lot of variation.
Yeah. Pardon me, I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No, that was it.
Okay. So I guess for an American audience, I mean for Americans, the big question is if the science is telling us that some really big problems are coming for the tens of millions of people, maybe even over 100 million people who live along our sea coasts on the west and east coast of the United States and the southern coast of the United States. If our science is telling us, hey, you got a really serious problem coming down the road, or even you have right now in your backyard, witness Katrina or Hurricane Sandy, but our politicians who are bought off, you know, in a political system where the Supreme Court allows big transnational corporations to buy politicians. We had when the Republicans were elected to the House of Representatives a little more than a year and a half ago, every single freshman Republican denied that climate change even exists, and they denied the basic science. How can a country have a dialogue in that kind of an environment? How do other countries deal with this?
I think it's a very difficult problem to do. Certainly we need evidence that we see change. And whilst we know that weather happens, climate is over very much more long timescales. So to try and present that evidence is, first of all, very, very difficult. With sea level, we're slightly different, that we do have some evidence that we have tide gauges, which measures the fall and rise of the tide and has done in many, many places around the world for many decades. So we have evidence, even if climate change isn't the issue, that sea levels actually change anyway, and that generally around the world they are rising. Now, how to get that message across of, you know, maybe we need to do something about this is very, very difficult. And that comes down to individuals or organisations actually saying, I think we need to look at the science, we need to look at sea level rise and think about what the long-term implications are if it is happening or if it isn't happening, and actually think about all the different situations that could occur. So perhaps in a century's time, we don't get caught out.
Yeah. or perhaps even less than a century, it seems.
Perhaps less than a century.
Yeah, who knows. Dr. Sally Brown, Research Fellow in Engineering and the Environment at the University of Southampton. This is a serious issue. Thank you for dropping by and talking with us about it today.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure. Steve Sotloff, by the way, this fellow who is the reporter with Time Magazine, this very, very problematic situation now. What are we going to do about this? You, in the previous hour, you heard me go through at some length what the godfather of this business, Osama bin Laden, had to say, that, you know, basically we're going to bait America into having a war with us so we can bleed you dry. And I would suggest to you, A, that the people who run ISIS are taking the exact same position that bin Laden did. B, this is, you know, back to what Dr. Brown was talking about. This is an oil-rich part of the world. It's all about fossil fuels. And C, well, at some level, it's all about fossil fuels. The original, you know, all of our original involvement in that region. And C, you are going to see now a media stampede. I mean, the right wing has already been there. From day one, Fox News was, oh, what's the president going to do about this? And, you know, you are going to see, well, we are watching a shock and awe campaign against this president to try to get him to involve the United States in a military, to re-involve the United States militarily in Iraq. And ISIS wants this more than anything else. If they can be seen as, you know, the legitimate anti-American force in the region. Keep in mind, a lot of the leaders, this guy al-Baghdadi, who is theoretically or presumably the actual leader of ISIS in Iraq, he was captured by us back during the Gulf War or during the Iraq War and then released by the Bush administration in 2004 and apparently released to the Iraqi government. And when he got out, nobody knows whether he was just released or whether he was one of these prison breaks or, you know, what, nobody knows. But this guy is following the bin Laden theorem so well, so smartly, and in fact, more smartly than bin Laden did, because he's using social media and things in ways that bin Laden couldn't even imagine. So where is this going to go? How does this thing play out? Norma, in Montgomery, Alabama, you wanted to speak to this issue about Saudi Arabia and their role in this?
Well, don't we have proof that Saudi has funded this? And if so, can't we make Saudi stop by, say, confiscating the thousands of acres they've bought here, including that 640,000-acre wheat field in Nebraska?
Well, is that owned by the Saudi government or by Saudi individuals?
I am not exactly sure.
I mean, if we're going after Saudi individuals, 7% of Fox News is owned by Prince Alawid, by a Saudi prince.
Yes.
So maybe we should confiscate Fox News?
Well, that would make me very happy. I hate Fox News. but you know, also when you stop and think about how many companies that they have primary ownership of here in the United States, are we going to wake up one day and have the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia say, I own your country now?
Yeah.
And, you know, put a stop to this and tell them that you cannot keep being our enemy when you keep buying our land. And you can't keep trying to control the rest of the world. If Syria doesn't want a pipeline through Syria, they don't have to let the Saudis or the UAE do that. They don't have to do what Saudi Arabia wants. And if Ukraine wants to have a relationship with Russia, we should not be supporting our oil interests in trying to take over Ukraine and help the Saudis run power plants into Ukraine. Nobody else ever asked what's on the other side of this, you know. And for the Saudis to try to essentially control the world, something needs to be done to stop it.
Yeah. Well, they're making the world safe for Salafi Islam, which is a tough one. Norma, thank you for the call. And the simple answer to why can't we confiscate Saudi stuff is that they're allies of us. And like I pointed out, you know, they own 7% of Fox News. they got a piece of everything. And I think, you know, having an alliance with Saudi Arabia is a good thing. Having them dial back some of the behaviors, that would be a good thing, too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's time to stop the several of the wars, I think, that Saudi Arabia is involved. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Shirley in Emmitsburg, Iowa, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Shirley. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. It's really nice to be able to talk to you. I'm a woman who adopted four children because I had miscarriage after miscarriage. Mm-hmm. Early term, thankfully, not like my mother who had late term ones.
Ouch.
I wondered if you would ever get Discovery Health Channel on, or simply go to the computer and you can learn that about half of the little fertilized eggs that are newly fertilized are flushed away before they ever become the beginning of babies.
Right, before they implant into the uterus. And it may be even higher than 50%. I mean, that's a rough guess.
You're right. And what I would also like to say is I was a claims examiner for Blue Cross Blue Shield when I was in my 20s. I'm in my 80s now. And back in those days, we had a multitude of DNCs, dilation and curettage, because that was the legal way that they could get the insurance companies to perform the or pay for the abortions.
Yeah.
Are you aware of that?
I am very aware of it. You know, I was a teenager in the 1960s, and I knew, I don't want to say many, maybe three or four women at that time who were teenage girls who had DNCs, you know, and they would just go off. You know, they'd be out of school for a day or two and go to the hospital, have a DNC. It's a in-and-out procedure. You don't have to stay overnight. And, you know, the story that we all heard from everybody was this is what women do when they have menstrual irregularities. Well, it turns out after abortion got legalized, DNCs just went away. And apparently the menstrual irregularity was that you're not having a menstrual period because you're pregnant.
And besides that, I wanted to say this. My mother was expecting when she was in her 40s, and like I said, she'd had so much problems before that the doctors didn't want to take care of her.
Right.
So when I took her, drove her to the doctor, I was in my upper teens, the doctor said, well, I'm going to make arrangements for you to go to a bigger town here in North Iowa and have this tumor removed.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother said, this is no tumor. It's kicking already. All
Whoa.
Tumors do that. So I'm going to make you get it in line for you to go. They named the hospital in the town where you can have this tumor removed. And my mother walked out and said to me, he knows that I'm pregnant. And she didn't go to have that tumor removed.
Right.
And the doctor refused to come and deliver her when she was delivering my darling little baby sister.
Wow.
So I just wanted to point out that there were doctors that were doing illegal abortions, and when they're far along,
right.
They called it a tumor.
Oh, so the early term abortions were called DNCs, which is basically just opening up the uterus and scraping out the insides, and which is how you do an abortion, I guess. And the late-term abortions were called tumor removal. That's amazing. Shirley, thank you for that, and thank you for the call. It's 20 minutes past. You know, abortion's never going to go away. It's been with us. I mean, there's biblical instructions for abortion. It's been with us forever. This needs to be between a woman and her God. And if she's religious, the religious figures in her life, if she has a partner, her partner, but she's the person who can make this decision. As Shirley's mom, she decided to keep the baby. We'll be back. So I'm curious your thoughts on ISIS and the Middle East. At what point do we as a country say, okay, you guys have done enough evil stuff that we are now going to get engaged in your war? Right? It took a really high threshold for us to engage ourselves in World War II. It took Pearl Harbor. And you know, at that point in time, the death camps were already running, and the odds are very high that we knew about it. So what's it going to take in the Middle East, or should it? I mean, on the one hand, you've got, as Colin Powell so elegantly said to George W. Bush, if you break it, you own it. It's a Pottery Barn rules here with regard to Iraq. If you're going to break this country, you better fix it afterwards. And Bush said, yeah, I'll just break it. And I'll stay there and I'll keep it broken until the end of my term, until the end of my 8 years, and then I'll hand it off to some other guy. Some poor schmuck, he can put it back together. That poor schmuck became Obama. And now he's facing this thing of, you know, how do I put this back together? The Taliban, by the way, is creeping back into Afghanistan as we speak. Not much discussed, but. And what the Taliban and ISIS have in common is their absolute hatred of women. By the way, last week, I think it was last week, might have been the week before, we had a fairly lengthy conversation about race on this program. And somebody called and said, and we were talking about white privilege. And somebody called and said, you want to see a good movie about white privilege? Go watch the Watermelon Man movie with Gottfried Gilbert, was it? Was the Gilbert? No, it's in any case. I have to go back and look. But the star of the movie is an African American who plays in whiteface during the first little bit of the movie. And, you know, overnight he turns into an African American and his life kind of falls apart. And it's a fascinating look. The movie was made in 1970. Gottfried Cambridge, that's right. Thank you. He was a big comedian back in that day. And you know, his life falls apart. I watched the movie yesterday. Louise and I watched the movie last night. This thing had been sitting in my inbox for a long time. You know, a couple of people actually who listen to the show saying, yeah, you got to see the movie. What I thought most fascinating about the movie was not so much its portrayal of white privilege, although that's very real and everybody gets it, but that's the obvious stuff. But there were two other things that I found were fascinating. Twice, Gottfried Cambridge, the Jeff something or other was the name of his character, Jeff Gerber. Twice he runs into, or the police track him down because he's a black guy, right? You're running while black, walking while black. He gets busted for this. Trying to get into a whites-only club, he gets busted for it. And the police officers, you know, they pull up in their car and they come out and they don't even have guns. They did not even have guns on their belts. And they stop. He's been running. He's bumped into a bunch of white people in a white neighborhood, knocked people over and whatnot. Everybody's convinced he was running away because he tried to steal something. And so the crowd of white people standing around. And here's Gilbert Cambridge. Gottfried Cambridge. And the police officer says, he's saying, I didn't steal anything. And they say, well, what's in your suit? What's in your carry-on bag, your briefcase? And he says, my shoes. So they have him take his shoes out of his bag and put them on, and they fit. And the cop says, well, those are your shoes. And then he turns to this crowd of white people, and says, did anybody here actually see him steal anything? And everybody says, well, we know he did. He was running. He's a black guy. And the cop said, but did anybody see him steal anything? And they're all like, no. And the police officer says to him, well, you can go. Think how differently that would play out, or did play out, in Ferguson. Or all around our country now. A, the police are hyper-militarized. B, super quick to pull their guns. And C, super quick to kill people. It's really, really sad. So anyway, I wanted to share that with you. I thought that was fascinating. Vicky in Temple, Texas. You think we should go after ISIS in Iraq?
Yes, I do. I really do.
What kind of threat do they represent to the United States of America?
Well, I think for one, they should never ever kill Americans and have it broadcasted to where Americans can see it, for one. For two, I think it's wrong that America is not doing nothing more to help these Americans over there that's doing their job as journalists. And for three, if a woman was running the situation, we wouldn't have the situation that we have right now, because the men would be so tempered up because a woman's running it that they wouldn't know how to accept it. as far as the prejudice is going on, I mean, prejudice is on all of us. It isn't just the blacks or the Spanish. It's also the whites. You know, I'm serious. I mean, I dropped from a job for $12 an hour to $7.75. I can't even survive anymore because there's no jobs out there because I'm not the right color. They don't want to hire me.
Well, you're not.
You know, and for three, the prejudice of women, you know, the thing about the women is we're strong and we're ambitious and we know how to get things done. And men don't do that. You know, they want to fight and be in war all the time. Women can actually discuss it out. I think those are the things that
there may be some truth to that.
I think a woman would do a lot better.
The other thing that I, although I would suggest that you're probably unaware of your own white privilege, but the other thing that I got from watching Watermelon Man was that in 1970, when the movie was made, all the women were secretaries. That was it. That was the only secretaries or wives. Those were the only roles that were acceptable for women then, and they had no power. And it was an entirely male world. And you know, he's, you know, touching women, making sexual remarks about them, all these kinds of things in the workplace was perfectly acceptable. And so it wasn't just the racism that's portrayed in this movie that was startling to somebody with 2014 eyes. Thank you, Vicki, for your call. It was also the sexism. It was pretty striking. It's almost like a time cap from 1970 to today. This Waterman, Melon Man movie. It's fascinating. Anyhow, 28 minutes past the hour. What would you do about ISIS? We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And how should we be responding to ISIS? Your thoughts? I'll share mine. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Interesting times we live in. Very interesting times we live in. Tim, in Sebowing, how do you say that in Michigan, the town?
Sebowing.
Sebowing. Okay, there you go. You're on the air. You wanted to talk about ISIS?
Yeah, Tom, longtime viewer. I'm a 68-year-old combat wounded veteran from Vietnam.
Whoa.
I would have thought we'd have learned the lesson 50 years ago, but it seems that we just keep going over the same thing again and again.
Ironically or not, it's actually not ironic, but the people who are seem to be speaking out most loudly about don't jump into that quicksand are the baby boomers, are people in their 50s, 60s, and you know, older, who are saying, hey, wait a minute, we should have learned, you know, Vietnam should have taught us this lesson. We don't want to do this again. We don't want another Vietnam. You know, which brings to mind Arnold Toynbee's perhaps apocryphal saying that when the last man who remembers the horrors of the last great war dies, when the memory of that of the horrors of the last great war dies, only the noble victories will be remembered, and the next great war becomes inevitable. And you know, it's almost like,
well, you would think that now people would have learned, but we keep doing the same thing over and over.
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely with you. And our military-industrial complex and our media keep pushing us into it because they both profit immensely off it. Tim, thanks a lot for the call and for your service to our country during a very, very difficult time, the Vietnam War. Thank you, Tim. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Yes, I'm glad that was a good ending.
All right.
About the military profiting. That's what this is all about. They're trying to get us into another war. They're going to show this beheading on TV for the next month.
Sure.
To try to guilt trip.
Well, they got a third American they're going to trot out in 2 weeks when the storm and drang from this one, you know, settles down.
Yeah, well, I'd ask these war hawks that are sitting there tonight when they go home and sit around the dinner table, pick out which daughter or son they want to send over.
Right.
Then call me, because I got two of them that are military age. You know, and I don't want to send either one of them.
Right.
That war means nothing to me. If those people want to fight it over there, fine. Send them the planes. Get the 8-10 Warthog that's a 50 caliber with a plane wrapped around it and help them that way. but you're not going to put my son or daughter's boots on the ground. I'm not going to subject them to beheadings. These people are animals. Just leave them alone. They'll finally kill off
you. Well, they're not animals. They're behaving like animals, and we've got to be very careful, Quirky, about that. We're all human beings here on this planet. It's important to point out, I think, that this animal behavior is something that you can track back to arguably the first Gulf War, to George Herbert Walker Bush, trying to take down a secular dictator. And, or you could take it back, 50 years before that, our propping up secular dictators in the first place, our fighting against elected democracy.
When you take a knife out of your pocket, cut somebody's head off, I got to call you an animal. That's just the lowest of human behavior.
I think the guy's a criminal and he should be punished for it.
Yeah.
And he's behaving like an animal. I would agree that he's behaving like an animal. But when you start calling people animals, it's this dehumanize the other thing that makes war easy. So if you want to be speaking out against war, you need to be very careful about using language that, like during World War II, we had all these slurs that we would use for Japanese people and German people. And during the Vietnam War, there was a whole set of slurs for people of Asian ancestry. And now, we've got to be careful with it. But Corky, I get your point. Thank you for the call. Steve in Maryville, Tennessee. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, well, thanks, Tom. But I'm not very politically correct as an ex-military guy. But you want to know what to do about ISIS? The same thing we need to do about the illegals. Seal the border with men. That can be done. I've been there as a Minuteman Project in 05. You can seal the border with people. Secondly, if we're concerned
about
immigration, why would I want to do what? Close the border?
We had an open border with Mexico for 200 years, Steve, and it wasn't until Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the laws that would cause, by and large, wealthy white employers to go to jail.
Sir. Wait just a moment, sir. This is Free Speech TV. Is this the Democratic hour or the Free Speech hour?
It's whatever you want to call it, Steve. I'm telling you what's so.
Let me talk.
If you go back to 1986 and look at what happened when Reagan redid our immigration policies and gave an amnesty to 5 or 6 million people, he then stopped enforcing the law.
We don't need a lesson in history. We need a lesson in the future.
No, I'm telling you, Steve, you've got the wrong bad guys. We don't have an illegal immigrant problem. We have an illegal employer problem.
Well, let me ask you this. Why, when they passed the E-Verify system, did the very first paragraph of the E-Verify system say, this is not mandatory. This is a voluntary law.
Because that's how the Republicans wanted it. This is how Republicans have wanted it since the 80s.
See, this must not be the free speech hour. It must be the Democrat hour.
I'm telling you, the Democrats and some Republicans passed comprehensive immigration reform in the Senate, sent it down to the House, and John Boehner's got it bottled up.
Have you been to the border in Arizona and seen what they're doing down there?
It doesn't matter, Steve. It doesn't matter. You can strut around and play Minuteman all day long and try to impress us with how much testosterone you have. It doesn't matter. People will only come here if there's something waiting for them.
Okay, then redo the E-Verify system and make it mandatory.
Well, that's what the law said in 1986, and no president has enforced that law since. No president has been willing to put rich white guys in jail. And I'm telling you, if you were to have a half a dozen perp walks, especially in the meatpacking industry and the construction industry, you would suddenly see hundreds of thousands of jobs that used to be good union wage jobs for Americans. You would suddenly see those jobs return.
So how would you think? We're talking about ISIS. I'm talking about a threat to this country with people that's going to kill us. That's the immigration issue.
Wait a minute. You think that because somebody's coming from Mexico looking for a better life, they're going to kill us?
Do you think that the ISIS people and the Arabs are not coming through the border at Mexico now?
No, they didn't. They didn't have to for 9/11. All they need to do is get a tourist visa.
I was there in 05, and more than 25 different countries. They had caught people from 25 different countries other than Mexico in 05.
So yeah, but I would guess probably all of them from Central and South America. The fact of the matter is
there were Arabs, there were people from Africa, there were people from all over the world coming through Mexico.
Yeah.
because it's a job for people down here.
If you can afford to get yourself to Mexico and hire a coyote and get across the border, you can much more easily afford to simply get a $50 tourist visa stamped in your passport and come into the United States through JFK Airport. This is how you got a couple million people a week who are coming to the United States from all over the world and on tourist visas, and you know, 20 of them decided to stick around and blow up the Twin Towers. They all came on visas. Every single one of them.
Why do we let anybody come over here then?
Well, you've got, well, first of all, the third largest industry in the United States is tourism. So if you want to take out the third largest industry in our country and just say, you know, we're not going to do that anymore, I suppose we could say to the rest of the world, sorry, we're closing our borders.
Well,
we're going to become just like East Berlin.
Let me leave by saying this, because you and I are a different frequency. Let me leave by saying this. The smart people, you included, and the Harvard guys and all the smart people have been running this country for the last 50 or 60 years.
I disagree. I disagree. We've had 34 years of Reaganomics, and it has caused serious harm to this country. Steve, let me ask you a question. Were you ever in East Germany or East Berlin when it was East Germany and East Berlin?
No, but what does that have to do with wanting to protect?
Because they had a wall around that country and around that city that was absolutely impenetrable, which is what you're advocating we do on the Texas border.
You're telling me now that we can't do anything to protect our country without having a history lesson about East Berlin.
I'm telling you, if you want to turn the United States into East Berlin,
the approach is don't directly answer the question or talk about the issue. But
your approach, Steve, is to turn America into East Berlin, and that's crazy. There's no reason for us to turn our country into East Berlin.
I said close the border until we figure out.
That's what they did in East Berlin. They said, we got a problem. We got people leaving. We got people coming. We can't control it. We got to close the border, and they did. How did that work out?
I don't care how it didn't work there. I'm interested about how we can make it work here.
Okay. How would you make it work here, Steve?
Free Speech TV. This isn't Free Speech TV.
I speak for myself, not for the television network, Steve. You know,
I speak for myself, but you're not letting me tell your audience what I think.
Okay, you got 30 seconds till we hit the break. It's yours.
Well, I could fix a lot in 30 seconds, but it's nothing's going to happen because we're going to have another 9/11, only worse, and everybody is going to start taking rights away from us.
I think you may well be right.
In our country, on the borders, and deporting people.
You know, I think you may well be right, Steve, but the 9/11 is not going to be done by people coming across the Mexican border. It's going to be done by people who fly into JFK Airport. And you've got 400 Americans over there in Syria right now fighting with these ISIS guys. You got 500 Brits fighting with these ISIS guys. You know, they've got American passports and British passports. They don't need to go through Mexico. But, Steve, thank you for the call. Interesting conversation. 15 minutes before.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So do you think that Steve is right, that in response to the beheading of Stephen Sotloff, we need to close our border with Mexico and every place else? Welcome back, Anita, in San Antonio, Texas. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't hear Stephen talk about closing the Canadian border.
Right. There's, you know, white people up there.
Yeah. Well, that's not what I wanted to talk about. I don't think it's an accident, Tom, that those hostages are being paraded out in those orange jumpsuits, like a Gitmo jumpsuits.
Right.
And I've also heard that the Americans have been waterboarded.
Yes. At least James Foley was, at least three times, yeah.
Why are there's four American hostages that were waterboarded. This is what I heard.
Right. I've
and they actually did say something about Gitmo and Abu Ghraib.
Yep.
As a reason for that.
Yep.
So I think we really need to think about closing Gitmo and maybe, you know, actually doing something about, you know, the people that torture people.
Yeah, is it time to arrest George W. Bush and Dick Cheney for having set this whole thing up?
Yeah, get back to moral high ground, because this has got to be a huge recruiting tool for
right.
these guys.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thank you, Anita, very much for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Dean, watching Free Speech TV in Los Angeles on DirecTV. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Hey there. Mr. Hartman, it's been several years since I've been able to speak with you, but I had an odd response to that guy in the last hour you had called, who had mentioned that the Christians revere women. And it made me recall a documentary I saw probably a decade ago called Under the Veil,
mm-hmm.
or Beneath the Veil, I think it is.
Right.
That ironically, he made a statement that was precisely what many fundamentalist Muslims feel, which is the reason they cover a woman in a burqa and keep her isolated and not functioning out in society freely is because they revere them.
Right.
And it's just eerily odd that that is the, and that's not the first time I've heard that type of response.
Yeah.
You're absolutely
right.
As a Christian nation, we should be protecting women from this evil practice of killing our babies.
Like it takes men to protect
really
women.
Back to me, the difference we have as far as the protection of that's given to us by the separation of church and state.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm with you. Well said, Dean. Thank you very much for the call, Joe. We got a minute to the break. It's yours. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hi, Tom. First of all, thank you for all that you do.
My pleasure.
I have an observation. Until, let's say, as recently as 4 months ago, the price of gasoline just jumped every time some small thing occurred in the Middle East anywhere.
Right.
And now the price of gas is constant with all that's going on. You know, the Iraq war is starting again.
Mm-hmm.
Ukraine, everything. To me, that's proof that the price of gas is not being controlled by the producing countries.
Or by market forces.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's being controlled by speculators. Yep.
Well, my theory is that the Republican Party is just sitting back saying, look, we're the good guys. You know, the price of gas is constant. We're, you know, going to keep...